They ain't gonna like this one.
Welcome to the Unapologetics Podcast. We're here, we are unapologetically black, unapologetically Christian, and unapologetically me, with no apologies.
Woo-wee. We got a lot to talk about. First things first, welcome back. Or if you're new here, welcome, welcome, or welcome forward. Would that be the opposite of welcome back? Anyway, I am your host, Malachi A. Scribe. That's spelled A plus sign scribe. The plus sign is silent. And this is the Unapologetics Podcast. I mean, you've heard the taglines in the beginning, so you already know what that's about. And if you aren't doing so already, whether you are a new listener or a frequent listener, I would very much appreciate a couple things. One, you follow us on social media. All the links are in the show notes. So you can find us on Instagram at the Unapologetics Podcast. Also, you'll find my Twitter and Facebook information there as well. If you look in the show notes, it'll give you a link to everything. Or if you go to the Unapologetics Podcast on Instagram, you will find the same link there. Also, if you would be ever so kind to become a patron on Patreon, once again, all the links are there, either on my Instagram page or in the show notes here, I would very much appreciate your patronage, showing your support for this podcast, more than just the listen, but like, you know, really backing that up monetarily, so that we can continue to do these things. Like, that kind of patronage is the reason why I'm able to get, like, new equipment for this podcast to make things sound better. It's the reason why I'm able to really continue to do this stuff at all, like upload episodes to the platform that I use to get it out to other platforms that brings it to you right where you are. And so much more that could transpire from your help. Last thing, if you like these episodes that you've been hearing, if you love these this podcast, please, you know, of course, like if your listening app for this allows you to do that, like these episodes, definitely leave a review for this episode and rate it. Leave a review for this podcast and rate it. That would help tremendously so that other people can easily find this podcast and we could get more people in on this conversation and learn and grow together. Yeah. So this is episode 13 of season 2. We are in our unconditional series. If you haven't listened to any other episode of season 2 and under the unconditional series, this series is basically a springboard for us to grow as people who were trying to be anti-racist so that racism doesn't become a hindrance and a stumbling block to those who are trying to live Christ-centered lives, especially black and brown folk who are trying to live Christ-centered lives. And then it also helps people who are not even Christian, you know what I'm saying, to work towards working towards anti-racism so that we are not, no one is a stumbling block to those who are trying to be successful in life. So really, you know, it helps everybody. Because, well, two things, like one, unconditional, like undoing something, like things that have conditioned us to think and behave in certain ways, like, so undoing that, and then unconditional as it relates to unconditional love, because fam, it is so difficult to love these days. Like, the world, it's constantly getting worse with each new generation. They face their own challenges and whatnot, and so it's difficult to love, especially like being a black Christian, especially being a black Christian in America. Like, so many black Christians or so many black people have left Christianity and left the church. So like this is when I get into my unapologetics here, because like through a series like this and this podcast, my petition to them and to others alike is for y'all to keep fighting. Keep fighting for love and keep fighting to love. I'm talking about the love that comes from above and that the love that is unconditional, and that cause us to operate in unconditional love, and that same love that calls us to call others into that same kind of love, that same kind of unconditional love. And so it's a standard that we're trying to hold up here. And I feel like, you know, Christianity, like that's what, in Christians, like that's what we do best, like pursuing unconditional love, feel me? Or at least we should. Like, I know we, not all of us like show it well all the time. Matter of fact, none of us show it well all the time if you're a human, because humans make mistakes. But like, you know, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like, don't stop the fight, you know, continue. Like, Black Christians, Black and Brown Christians, like, hold your ground, stand on that, especially like when you're standing up for truth and justice in this world that is constantly telling you that you are fighting unworthy causes to liberate yourselves. Fam, like, especially when that comes from the church, fam, stand your ground. You know what I'm saying? Like, maintain your peace and joy. That doesn't mean like don't face the conflicts that arise. No. What I'm saying is, when those conflicts arise, maintain your peace. That doesn't mean like stay silent. No. I'm not telling you to police yourselves and stay quiet. No. What I'm saying is, if you look at Jesus Christ in the book of Hebrews, the writer says, "For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross." Jesus died like the blackest death out there, and I don't mean to characterize it by saying that, but like, think about it. He got killed, he got murdered for something he didn't even do. Man was completely innocent. We see that when we look at situations like, you know, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Drayshon Reed, like countless other situations. We see the narrative of Christ in there. And so like, this lifestyle that we're living is worthy. I know this world is telling us that Christianity is a white man's religion. It is a lie, fam. It is a lie. I know white people have used Christianity as a tool to oppress other people, but they used a form of godliness, feel me? They used an off-brand of Christianity. They didn't use unconditional love that they've been called to, because if they were, this stuff wouldn't happen. You know what I mean? So, like, with that being said, like, endure like Christ did. Take up that cross, you feel me? Matter of fact, you're blessed when people persecute you and revile you, as the scripture says. It says in Matthew 5, like, you are blessed when people curse your name and, like, when they revile you because you stand up for righteousness. You know what I mean? Matter of fact, you hunger and thirst for righteousness, says in the same chapter. You are blessed. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. So, like, God ain't going to leave you hanging. Christ ain't going to leave you hanging. Don't leave him hanging. You feel what I'm saying? Like, keep fighting that fight. Don't leave the church at large. Maybe you need to leave a particular church, but don't leave the church at large because of the shortcomings of its members. And by its members, I mean perhaps some of its members, not the vast majority, because then you feed into the narrative that Christianity indeed is a white man's religion when it is not. They do not take up the major populace, the majority populace of Christians around the world, or churches around the world. Okay, so there were like four white Christians and Christians who, how can I put this? For others, like, Yeah. For white Christians and like for others who are like starting to come into the knowledge of this stuff who are not black, like the Unconditional series, it helps you as well. And even helps those who refuse to acknowledge these types of things so that y'all can stop being a hindrance to black and brown Christians. Especially like as it pertains to the events. So like I'm recording this post January 6, 2021. And, you know, if you're aware of what happened in DC and at the Capitol building, the mob that came through, and everything, like, it's just what I've noticed that has been like a stumbling block for black and brown Christians is the inconsistencies and hypocrisy, in white Christians' partiality, like when it comes to the way they approach issues pertaining to race, pertaining to this situation, like them being either slow to condemn or silent to condemn what happened that day, as opposed to everything that they had to say about protest centering the mattering of Black lives. I'm not calling them BLM protests because it's not just like BLM, the organization there. There's also people who share in the sentiments Black Lives Matter, sharing the idea Black Lives Matter, which, like, I'm creating a necessary dichotomy between the group and the statement. Not to say that I'm condemning BLM, the organization. No, I'm just saying, like, not everyone, like, I'm slow to call it those protests that, because some people have a hard time dichotomizing between the group, the movement, and the idea. And even when I say the movement, I have to dichotomize that, because then once again I'm saying there's a difference between the group Black Lives Matter, the movement, and the movement itself for Black lives. You feel what I'm saying? Like the civil rights movement. Yeah, I mean, but anyway, so like I just noticed a lot of inconsistencies, like people who had all the criticisms last year in 2020 but did not have the same criticisms for what happened on January 6, 2021. People who came for Colin Kaepernick and criticized him for simply kneeling during the national anthem, and I won't even get into that because you need to look at the history of the national anthem itself and all of the lyrics of that song, not just the ones that people sing at sporting events and whatnot. Those same people were silent towards what happened on January 6th. Yeah, like it makes it hard for, and like, I'm talking about those who are Christian, it makes it hard for us to love being in the body of Christ, to love being a part of whatever church we're going to. Like, if you're there, it makes it hard for us to represent Christ together when y'all do stuff like that, when y'all pull stuff like that. And so, and even at the Capitol storm, I remember seeing a picture of someone who had a huge banner that they put over a ledge of the Capitol building that said Jesus Saves, in the same formatting and font and color scheme of those Trump flags, the Trump 2020 or 2021 flags. I don't know if that, I can't remember what year it had on there. And it's like, that's such a stumbling block. That's such a misrepresentation of us, because I wholeheartedly believe that Christ did not approve of that. You know what I'm saying? Like, why? Because that whole situation was predicated on a falsehood. The falsehood that is the election was rigged. The election was not rigged. Like, there's a bunch of information out there, a bunch of confirmations that are bipartisan confirmations that the election was not rigged. So why are we attaching Christ to this? And why are we attaching Christ to nationalism and to this country to just like have our political sets and our political opinions? And by political, I mean like political parties, to have those in the major representation in the White House and in public offices. That's not what Christianity is about, per se. Don't get me wrong, there can be Christians in those parties, but the party itself isn't Christian. That's the point I'm making. We're muddying the waters, blurring the lines here. No, we need to make those necessary separations so that we are not saying to be Christian is to be white, to be Christian is to be a nationalist, to be Christian is to be a white supremacist, and to be Christian is to be racist. Nah, fam. We need to be intentional with our very language with these situations. And here we are on episode 13, Unconditioning Racist Language in the Church. Oh, yeah, we're going there. So my guest today is Pastor Colby Hill, and I'll have him introduce himself in this next part. as well as chop it up with them about unconditioning racist language in the church. Let's get it. Okay, so everybody, I'm here with Pastor Colby Hill from, I'm trying to remember the name of you, because like the whole transition happened, I keep wanting to say, I'm like, yeah, he's not even in Indy anymore. Right, go ahead. Just introduce yourself. Let these people know who you are.
So if you're listening in the Indianapolis area, I was formerly with Heartland Church, right on the edge of Indianapolis and Fishers. But last year we made a transition out to the DC metro area, and I'm now the lead pastor of Encounter Church in a DC suburb called Waldorf, Maryland.
Waldorf, Maryland.
Yeah. Or as they say out here with the East Coast accent, Waldorf. I mean, Waldorf, son.
With the sun at the end of it, right? Oh, that's funny. So, I mean, like, did ever in the late, like the past 10, 15 years, or sorry, 5 or 10 years, did you imagine yourself in this space? Like, was that something that you're working towards? Like, what's the story behind that?
Yeah, we always wanted to come back to the DC metro area. Mm-hmm. Toya worked out here. My wife worked out here when she was in college. She interned for 3 years straight. And so we always said we wanted to kind of come out here and start our professional careers here. But we had a baby early on, and it was just way more practical and economical to start a family in Indianapolis versus out here, because the cost of living is so high. Wow. And then on the other side of that, I always wanted to be a senior leader. I always felt like that was something up ahead. I just needed to pay my dues and wait for God to ordain that to be so. And he did that this year in the middle of a pandemic.
Come on now. Like, y'all, don't tell me what this guy can't do. Come on now. In a pandemic. Come on. That'll preach all by itself.
Yeah, man. Progress in a pandemic. That sounds like somebody preached that message.
Oh. If any pastors or ministers are listening, you know, just remember who put you on.
No credit necessary. You know, we still beg and borrow from each other all the time, teachers and preachers.
It'd be like that. Right. Right. So how did you find yourself in a place like this ministry, like moving from, like, and you said these questions ain't off limits. So, you know, I ain't going to try to like say anything that'll incriminate you or anything like that. But like, how did you find yourself going from one predominantly white space, like, to another, in the Christian setting in terms of ministry and whatnot? Was that also by choice, or is this just some, like, you definitely heard the call and you responded?
Yeah, it was the latter. I definitely felt called into multi-ethnic spaces. I think that was, when I look back now, you know, hindsight is 2020.
I see what you did there.
Thank you. And so when I look back on like my upbringing and life beginning in college, or high school rather, mm-hmm. and then on into college, I see how God was preparing me to minister in multi-ethnic spaces, attending Cathedral High School and then Purdue and IUPUI for university. And then being raised in a Black family, being raised in a Black church, in the AME church, and being surrounded just by Blackness, but then being forced into these predominantly white spaces, I started feeling that leading from God to be in a multi-ethnic space, mm-hmm. In my ministry. And so that's when I left the AME church and ventured out, and I landed at Heartland first, you know. And to their credit, Heartland's a multi-ethnic church.
Yeah, I know. Like, I feel like I know most of the people that I know who go to Heartland are Black.
Yeah.
I didn't expect that. So, like, when I came to visit, And, you know, unfortunately, it was because of an untimely death. I was looking around. I was like, oh, I thought White was just the location that they were at, you know, 116 or whatever out there in Fishers. But I'm like, oh, okay. Oh, yeah. That's cool. We out here. We out here too.
It was shocking to me when I first went. And when we left our church, we were searching for churches that were multi-ethnic, and they were few and far between in the Indy metro area. And
right.
So
only know when one.
There's a handful now, especially at the time when we were looking. It was 2013, I think.
Mm-hmm.
2012, 2013. And so I could list them on one hand.
Yeah.
If that, and wouldn't even fill up one hand.
Right.
but now I,
you didn't say one twice. That's what happened. Right.
But yeah, it was a blessing for us to find the church. I matured so much there. I got to give credit to the senior pastor there, Pastor Darren. He is a white leader that grew up in the Caribbean around Black people, Black and brown people. And so, you know, he more than most in leadership, especially in a white evangelical space, understands a little bit more. And that doesn't say, you know, things were perfect there racially, but I think at least from a leadership perspective, he was one that was humble enough that was willing to grow in that area, which was huge.
Yes. It does make all the difference.
Yeah.
Cause like you would think, like, two things with that. One, being in a Christian church setting would bring some level of safety and security as you are. And then secondly, you would think that, like, people are thinking the way that you do about, things that pertain to even specific as the Black community. It's like, oh, y'all should get it when we're talking about, like, unconditional love that comes with a form of social justice, or that also comes in the form of social justice. Like, yeah, Christians get that. Like, that's a standard concept right there, right?
I didn't realize how big of an assumption that was.
Mm.
But yeah, it's not the norm for in Christian spaces for people to think that way, unfortunately. So you have a lot of Christian spaces that where people, I'll say this, white evangelical spaces, let's get more specific,
right,
where the majority still thinks that color blindness is okay.
You're right, right.
That think that's the goal versus it being a defect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I look at it. Color blindness is a defect. It is not the goal.
Right. And I feel like it's a see. Right. And I feel like it's offensive to actual colorblind people, you know?
And I know some, you know, and they all like, yeah, you don't want to be colorblind. It's like, I want to see what you see. You
right.
Know?
I'm trying to get like you could. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
So, like, what are like some key moments where you found yourself coming into the realization that that was an assumption of how, you know, those church spaces think about or operate with the idea of what to do about racism or yeah, stuff like that.
Well, just the passion and urgency that I had that I don't often see in those spaces,
mm-hmm.
being a shared value. And so there's a reticence, there's a hesitancy to get involved openly in racially divisive or potentially racially divisive areas.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I was younger and trying to climb the ladder, so to speak, in ministry leadership. And so I was trying to figure out when do I press on the gas and when do I, you know, lay on the brakes.
Right.
So there would be times where I would let stuff go by, mm-hmm. you know, and wouldn't say anything. And then there were other times that I felt it was important enough for us to have some sort of presence or response or activity in the area of social justice. But again, you know, until 2020, those conversations were few and far between.
Right.
I feel like when 2020 happened and George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and all those, we know those were just the cherry on top of an ice cream sundae that nobody wanted to partake in.
Right.
But, you know, so there were so many other names that have been that became hashtags over the years, but for mm-hmm. some reason 2020 became a catalyst. Mm. And it kind of pushed a lot of folks that were in multi-ethnic or white evangelical spaces to go, okay, we got to do something. And for many of us that are Black or minority leaders in those churches,
mm-hmm.
we're just like, well, it's about time.
Right.
We've been saying this for years.
Right.
But it was just, it had the attention of, you know, the rest of the world. And I think a lot of folks looked at it as, oh, if we don't do something now, if we don't say something now, we're going to be the bad guys.
Yeah. And like, do you ever struggle with that? Like the thinking about authenticity in those conversations and in those moves that leadership and white evangelical spaces make, like, okay, do you ever wrestle with that thought of like, are you doing this because you actually care, or are you doing this because you care only about your image, your security, and your and public opinion?
Yeah. I mean, to be completely transparent, absolutely. That's something that is on my mind, and I'll often feel like a skeptic or a little jaded mm-hmm. In my perspective, but that's because of my experience in history. You know, it's not unfounded to think and feel that way when you've seen it repeatedly, and not yeah. from a congregational perspective. I've seen that from inside mm-hmm. as a part of the leadership, and seeing how, I guess the best way to put it is, it can completely, racial issues sometimes can completely go over white leaders' head because they're thinking about everything, there's this word again, from the perspective of their own experience.
Right.
And not thinking about, I've had the pleasure of serving in two churches that have had a 50-50 split almost in white and Black congregants.
Really?
In the disparity, the makeup of the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a majority white leadership, when that same sort of demographic split isn't represented in leadership,
exactly,
then you only get that white perspective.
Right.
And so when things happen that disproportionately affect Black and Brown people, but you're in a leadership space that only represents 50% of the population of the church, then they're not thinking through,
right?
Because they don't have lived experience. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like it's exactly what you said. Like they're speaking from their personal experience rather than from that of others, because they're not either hearing from other or positioning others to be able to speak, and they're not positioning themselves to like learn in that way. Like I remember, like, just real quick, speaking of the whole colorblind thing, the first time I heard that term, and we'll get into the topic of unconditioning racist language in the church. The first time I heard that particular term, and was kind of dumbfounded by it, because like I didn't have the language to combat against even that idea. And I was kind of like gaslighted for a hot second and kind of stunned, didn't know what to do. First time I heard that was at my undergrad. I graduated from Anderson University, for y'all who don't know, predominantly white, small Christian university. And what I was doing was I was trying to convince some people in leadership that we needed more Black and brown leaders, and there needed to be intentional direct, what's the word I'm looking for? Intentional effort to change that, the makeup of their leadership, like the ethnic makeup of their leadership, especially if they wanted to even see more Black and brown leaders in the general fold. And if we really wanted to see changes, because a part of our leadership training was, we would do one session on diversity. It's always that one session. They call in that one person who's the director of the diversity department on campus. And like, she did a wonderful job, but they did a terrible job of applying that. And so I was telling them, I was like, you have to intentionally, and I don't know why I'm at a loss for words right now. There's one deliberate. Yeah, you had to deliberately do this to like figure out like who had the skills to like even lead a worship session and our super retreats for our leaders. I'm like, it's so white on that stage literally all the time. Maybe one brown person or one Black person, but I know good and well there are like 10 other people who could sing the same song or sing a different song, because I feel like we're always singing the same kind of songs. And so that's when that person told me, they was like, oh, I grew up in Florida and there were, you know, a lot of different people down there, just pretty diverse. So like, you know, she literally said, so Malachi, when I see you, I don't really see color. And I'm sitting there like, why do I now feel bad for thinking about this? Why do I now feel bad about thinking that diversity should have a level of directness and deliberation to it, where you got to call out what is and call forth what you want and make it happen? And now like I'm feeling like I'm a sinner, because you know what I'm saying? Yeah. The things,
you know, the sin of white supremacy and racism is so insidious in that way, to where it makes somebody that is pursuing something that is righteous and good feel like they're doing something wrong.
Right.
And we see that with the gaslighting. We see that with, you know, all sorts of a lack of acknowledgement for why we even need to pursue this and why it's good, because it's so entrenched systemically that its goal is to continue to prop itself up and never be challenged. And so somebody that says they grew up in Florida around diversity cannot possibly say they don't see color. You absolutely see color.
Right.
You absolutely see cultural differences, because you were immersed in it.
Right.
What you're saying is, I choose to look past that, not in a good way, not in a good way.
Right.
I choose to look past that in an effort to make you be a part of this and not seek out true diversity.
Right. Because like the world, so, go ahead.
Let me say this. That is a direct intent to cause you to deny your identity. And so people like, you know, people like you and me that went to predominantly white schools, that we lived for a part of our lives in a space of in-betweenness.
Yes.
Because we could relate to the hood, because that's kind of where we came from.
Yep.
But also we could navigate white spaces. And we talked a little different and dressed a little different and sounded a little different, like different things. So we kind of were in this in-between space where both, like, remember Stretch Armstrong, the little doll that had the stretchy arms?
Yeah.
we felt like that because both sides, we were being pulled to try and assimilate into both sides.
Yes.
And that's, I think that's a choice that we don't have to make. Like, diversity is a celebration of who everybody is in their individual uniqueness.
Celebration. Come on now. Come on.
It's not making you be like me.
Right. That's assimilation.
It's celebrating. It's celebrating you for you.
That's right.
And making room for all of us to be at the table together.
And making like room.
There's nothing more gospel than that.
Come on now. You better look. Look, listen, you're preaching now. I'm here for it. And like, here's the crazy thing, the hypocrisy of even that moment, because now I'm starting to remember what else was said in that very conversation. When I brought up the music thing, she was like, well, we do have a lot of white people here at this university and at our retreats and whatnot, and this is what they like. I'm like, if I wish I would have like internalized it more, but like I couldn't because like I was on the spot. All this stuff didn't come until later, my thoughts about it, but I wish I could have said in that moment, like, so you do see color.
And again, that's evidence of, I want to preserve this level of comfortability.
Yes.
And this as the status quo. So in that conversation, what that person revealed was, this is who we're catering to.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we want to continue to do.
Right.
Cause if we rock the boat, then we might disrupt this majority white space, this good thing that we have going. And the only way to make things diverse outside of God intervening and causing diversity by sending people is to do it intentionally. You have to do it intentionally. Otherwise, only the people that are going to be comfortable with Hillsong and you know, I forget, all the
Michael
others.
Tomlin,
Mike
Crowder.
Tomlin, yeah, yeah. All
Toby Mac is apparently the only rapper out there.
So as long as that is the status quo, mm-hmm. You're only going to attract and keep people that like that.
That's right.
Being intentional says let's keep this,
right?
But let's also add into that, because I always say, diversity is not a subtraction, it's addition.
Addition, yes.
It is saying let's keep this and now add into that mix some gospel artists, some Christian hip hop artists, some Latin, whatever.
Right. You know,
because when we put that out there, we'll attract people that like
right.
that.
And on top of that, normalizing it.
That's the second step. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I say there's phases to diversity, mm-hmm. especially as it relates to the church. Your first phase is being welcoming.
Hmm.
Is just to say, hey, you know, we want all people to feel welcome here. And when
right.
they walk through the doors, you know, everybody don't turn and look sideways like, oh, some... the others have arrived.
The others.
but once you get past, a lot of churches stop there though, because being welcoming doesn't force you to change your cultural sensitivity.
Mm.
Being welcoming still says we still want you to assimilate and become like us.
Right.
But then you've got to move towards being accepting of people. When people come with their differences, you've got to accept them for who they are and what they bring to the table. And then that last one, you got to celebrate.
Man, like, it's like, I swear you are like, we're in the same vein because, I don't know if you ever met Anna, but, it was her and you've met Keandre and me. So we took a look at our evaluation metrics for teachers at the Excel Center, and we fought to change the language of the evaluation of measuring cultural competency for teachers. The height of it was the cultural sensitivity, like just addressing issues of equity and injustice in the classroom. And like I took a hard, drove in a hard nail to that. I don't think that's the right metaphor. I took issue with it because I'm like, if you're really trying to be culturally competent, the height of it is not just addressing issues. The height of it is not just being culturally sensitive, cultural competency. There has to be that level of celebration after it. And like, that's how we begin to normalize it. So we did like a whole session over it at our last conference that we had. So I feel like you, when you were speaking, I was like, oh, was he listening when we were talking about this? That's, it's good. Just saying that to say it's good to know that other people are thinking this way.
Yeah. And it permeates across different disciplines. So that's not just in teaching, like that's in the church too.
Yes.
And at the core of competency is understanding.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have an understanding, not just an acknowledgement. You got to move past that and get to an understanding of other people and who they are and identity and all that sort of stuff. And you can't do that colorblind. You can't do that holding on to your comfort and bias. You got to be able to fully push past that and listen and understand somebody so that you can then celebrate them.
That's it.
And that's where we get to inclusion. I gotta close this blind because I got the sun starting to come in on me.
See, look, like the God's glory in his face is shining on you, saying yes. That's the confirmation right there. So while you're doing that, I'll go ahead and put this question out there. So, what are some terms that you either hear now or have heard over the course of your involvement in ministry, or even just in church in general, especially like in more diverse spaces or like predominantly white spaces, like, cause you know, it could exist in both. What are some terms that you have heard in church that are inherently racist?
Okay. This could probably get us into a little trouble, but let's go there.
Hey, I'm here for it.
So I used about a couple months ago, back in October, we did a Standing Together series. We called it Standing Together. And the big predominantly white church, but it's a multi-ethnic church.
Yeah.
In the area, and myself, we came together to talk about these sorts of issues.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta
save, because like I'm gonna go back and watch it. I think I saw it like when you guys were pubbing, and I meant to chime in. Yeah.
So one of the illustrations that I used was Malcolm X, in the movie Malcolm X. When he's in prison and he's first being indoctrinated or illuminated, mm-hmm. in a way, his teacher, his mentor, is showing him the dictionary and showing him the differences between Black definitions and white definitions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we still utilize that sort of language to today. So everything that's Black is negative. Mm. Black male, Black bald, and everything and Black is dirty and dark and evil.
Mm-hmm.
And everything associated with whiteness is pure and clean and holy.
Yep.
And light.
Yep.
And so you have this dichotomy of those two things. And here's the thing. It's present all throughout the Bible.
All throughout, that's right.
But it's twisted. The way that it's talked about is twisted. So the Bible often compares white and purity with crimson and scarlet and red.
Really now?
It's not with Black.
Mm.
Oh. It's with red. So it's talking about our sinfulness and the blood that covers that.
Wow.
And then to make us therefore pure and clean and white as snow. You know, we know the song. He washed us white as snow.
Right.
So even in that sort of language, there's a misperception that the Bible supports what's out there, and that's not true. The Bible talks about not black and white, it talks about red and white.
It's ooh.
And so, I mean, Isaiah 1:18, you know, that's where we get our sins were as scarlet.
Wow.
Red as crimson.
That's it.
And he washes us white or whiter than snow.
Right.
So you see that, and you see that repeated throughout the Old and the New Testament.
And if I could say this real quick, and like even thinking about, I remember I did a poem. This is back when I was in my undergrad, and like I was looking at the scripture in Isaiah that talked about God and his sovereignty over like even chaos and calamity. He's like, he said in so many words, like, I create goodness and calamity, like darkness and light. So even if you tried to put the image of blackness in the sense of darkness, in the sense of evil, there is, and this is a very raw idea, so like I might regret saying this later and be like, nah, man, you shouldn't have said that, because like I don't want to sound like I am incriminating our own people, but like I'm just kind of giving someone the benefit of the doubt, but just for a moment, only to start them somewhere and to bring them to a new level of, or another way of thinking. But it's like, even if you thought that, you need to be seeing everybody as the imago Dei, the image of God.
Right.
Everything is being reconciled back to God, or sorry, not even reconciled. Everything is being redeemed, not necessarily redeemed from their own doing of, but redeemed from the mentality and the opinion that you had over them. It's the same with the Gentiles. These weren't, I mean, like, yes, the inherent sin of everybody, but they weren't more sinful than you were. They got redeemed because last time we checked, all of us are human. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and God is right. No respecter of person in that sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that sort of language, that wasn't intended to be racist, but was adapted and adopted to prop up the white supremacist narrative and the racist myth, then became internalized, internalized racism. So now you have people that view themselves a certain way internally, because of the language that they've been really indoctrinated with. And so if I'm always told that dark equals bad, evil, sin, and light or white equals good, purity, holy, clean, then I will always look at myself in the negative, with a negative slant. And I will always aspire to be like white, light, I'll always be heading in that direction. This is where you get the Uncle Ruckus. this is where you get Uncle Tom. This is where you get, I forget Samuel Jackson's character in,
right.
in Django. Like,
yes.
You get that because
this is where you get myself. Candace Owens. Let me stop.
You get...
I ain't gonna go there right now, but go ahead.
Blacks it. Yeah, this is where you get that sort of thinking and mentality, because all that you've heard all your life, everything surround. People talk about, I hear white evangelicals especially talking about, or white conservatives talking about how they are weary of talking about race. And I go, that's because you've had the privilege of not being defined by this.
That's right.
It is completely pervasive to any person that is not included in whiteness. Our lives are completely surrounded by being defined according to our skin color.
Right. Like defined and subjected. So it's like, it makes me think about like when in white church spaces, they say things like, oh, this, whether it be the gospel or conversations about the gospel or something like that. Oh, this transcends race. It's like, but what does that mean? What does that mean?
That's a racist term right there. Racist phrase. Something mm-hmm. transcending race. That means I'm tired of what that is. All those are dog whistles, in my opinion.
Yes, sir.
And a lot of people think dog whistle is just for politics. No, it ain't.
No.
It's all kinds of stuff. but that is code for I don't want to talk about this sort of subject. Let's talk about something that I consider to be a higher topic. And that ultimately means we don't have to talk about race. Let's talk about something else.
Right. And by we mean me.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you hear those that are woke will say, we don't want to center ourselves in a conversation that isn't about us.
Mm.
And I have some woke friends of mine. Dr. Kara Allen Soldati was a high school classmate of mine, and she's a social activist in Chicago now. But she's an amazing example of a white ally that supports, acknowledges, and celebrates different cultures, and doesn't center herself
right
and her whiteness.
That's the key.
To be the center of every conversation.
That's it.
She utilizes her privilege and platform to prop up other people and celebrate them. And that's what it's really about.
That's good. That's good. What are some other terms that you've heard that people just don't think about? Like even in conversations between even like lay ministers or everyday conversations or things that are discussed, like not only on the pulpit, but like in the pews. Mm. What are some things that we're not thinking about where it's like, I need you to think deeply about what you just said.
Well, I got into a recent discussion in a Black theology group on Facebook about a person that was, they were looking for a new church home.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying, what type of churches should I be looking for or looking out for?
Oh no.
And we got into a conversation and folks were saying, you know, get into a gospel centered church. And I said, oh, when I hear that, red flags start going up for me, because look at who refers to themselves as gospel centered churches.
Right.
And again, we have to be aware of not just the overt racism, but we have to be on the lookout for the covert stuff, the dog whistles.
That's it.
And so a lot of times when a church refers to itself as being gospel centered, and I caught all kind of flack for saying, be careful, because a lot of them, what they're saying is, you know, we are a white reformed church and don't want, you know, anybody that isn't going to fall in line with this sort of thinking. And it was like, I never thought that asking about that sort of thing in church would have been a racialized.
Right.
Like, it's not racial. It shouldn't be racialized, but it is.
Right.
So that's one of those. Gosh, there's so many things. The mentality of bootstrapping, you know, picking yourself up and moving forward. Of that stuff is racial language, even that's infiltrated the church.
Right. If we can dial back for a hot second, because like, I want to lean in on that, like even that discussion of like looking for a church home or a different type of church home and what to look out for or watch out for, like even terms like urban, like I do a poem where I say like near the end, it's like, because going to a black church, sorry, because going to a white church is just going to church unless you want to come visit my church, because you've always wanted to visit a black church. I mean, urban, I mean, inner city, I mean, charismatic.
Yes. Yes. All of those terms have been racialized. And it's like, urban is racial? Like, have you been to the city?
Right.
Like, every urban environment that I've ever been in has been diverse.
Yes.
But for some reason, when you say the word urban, that signifies black or brown. When you say inner city,
mm-hmm.
you not only think racially, but you think socioeconomically. So I think impoverished black kid. Mm-hmm. When I go, let's help the inner city youth.
So you these know, poor black people, yeah.
Poor black kids. Gosh, what was it? Oh, charismatic.
Yeah.
Is often overwhelmingly about the black church and our expression of worship, or say like Assemblies of God is a charismatic movement, and they are historically a much more inclusive and diverse group.
Mm-hmm.
But that, you know, they're too big on the Holy Spirit, and you know, they kind of weird, you know,
right. So,
You kind of,
whether it's too emotional, like the emotional base. Yeah.
That's another one. It's too emotional. That is another dog whistle, in my opinion, for race. And all those things, I mean, you think about it, at the center of them is a lack of willingness to be outside of my own comfort zone. Whenever I say, you know, whenever somebody says that whenever they use these sorts of labels, what they're really saying is, I don't, that's not for me. And I don't want to be outside of my comfort zone, but yeah, you're right. In your poem, exactly right. Like, I want to go to a black church. I want to experience that, you know, but I don't want to stay there.
Right, just a visit.
And that's the difference. Black folks forever have assimilated yes. into white culture and been a part of white churches.
Right.
But we're the minority in those spaces. But when you're in the minority, that means you have a minority of power and influence. And as long as the dominant culture refuses to place itself in minority settings where it won't have the maximum amount of influence and power over a situation,
yeah.
then we'll see things remain the same.
Mm. Yeah. If you can speak to two audiences, with the same question, what are some steps that people can take towards like unconditioning of racist language in the church? If you can speak to the, let's characterize this person like this millennial black in any, like, well, maybe this would be several people, but like any of those spaces, like whether they are in the black church context where it's like, okay, we're seeing blackness on every major area of life on a daily, but now I'm seeing some of these conversations out here that white Christians are having. It's like, what are y'all talking about? Or what do I do with that? And then of course the ones who were like, are on the, you know, that are being stretched, or the Stretch Armstrong. Is that what it was called? I never knew what it was called. Yeah. I just always seen it.
Yeah.
And then everybody else.
Yeah, so gosh, that's such a good one, especially for black millennials, because that's actually who I feel called to. That's like my target
mm-hmm.
audience. And something that you mentioned earlier that's key for that demographic is authenticity.
Hmm.
Black millennials especially, they crave it. They need authenticity, yeah. authentic conversation. Don't do something if it's not core to who you are.
Yeah.
Don't try and be somebody that you're not. And also, don't say stuff like it's time out for do as I say and not as I do.
Right.
Millennials want you to live it. Like, don't just tell me what you believe. I need to see you living that out.
Yes.
And be connected to a cause. And so that's something that's huge in this generation. And I think it's great. I think it's something to be celebrated. And, you know, Black millennials have a bad rap, man. You know, folks are afraid to turn over in the Black church. Folks are afraid to turn over leadership to millennials because for fear of what they will do to this established institution. And I don't think there's any, I think it's unfounded to think that way. I think Black millennials aren't going to take the church and Black church especially and just completely demolish everything that it's built on. I think Black millennials are actually going to take things a step further.
That's right.
While at the same time, so deeper into our identity and who we are, but at the same time, kind of like Hezekiah stripping away and implementing reforms.
Hmm.
Hey, let's not just do things because it's what our ancestors did, because there's a whole line of our ancestors that was doing things wrong and God never told them to do it this way in the first place. So let's actually get to a place where this is what the word says, this is what God wants us to do, and this is who we are, and let's move forward from that space.
That way people will want to actually build the wall with you and not just there by yourself. That's Hezekiah, right? Was that the wall of the
Nehemiah.
Temple? Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know why I get those two like mixed up.
Well, I mean, they go hand in hand because Nehemiah was a reformer and a builder as well. He and Ezra, you know, they're coming back to a broken down city of their cultural heritage, and they're having to rebuild it and face opposition from the dominant culture around them.
Yeah.
And so that whole let's build rebuild our city with a weapon in one hand and a tool to build in the other hand. You know, I think we need to adopt that.
You're right.
Because I mean there's an onslaught of, you know, we shouldn't just be talking about what's good for Black folks.
Right. Why not? When are we going to? Like, who is going to do it if we don't?
Yeah. You know, that's age old. That's as old as Black Panthers being demonized by the FBI.
Right.
Because they were trying to uplift and empower their community.
That's, right.
You know, we see that happen cyclically throughout history.
Yeah. And I was telling a friend
I think it's going to happen in the church now.
Woo. Yeah. And like, you know, perhaps it's scary for some. I was telling a friend just last night, I was like, one thing that I was taught a couple of years ago and I've noticed ever since is some people are like really afraid of a Black person. And in that context, I heard it was like, especially a Black male, like this society is always afraid of a Black male who knows himself and who loves himself too. It's a scary thing for some, because like all we've known and have been taught is to deny ourselves, to hate ourselves. And even in the church, deny yourself, that's more racist language right there. Take up your cross. It's like, but the cross is not necessarily me losing what God has given me, which is this Black body that has not been redeemed in this society, or I don't even know if I want to say redeemed, but like has not been affirmed in this society.
Because like my blackness, my Black body, my who I am, my identity culturally is not a part of that cross that I need to bear.
Right. I know the cross is brown, but
yeah, that is not a part of that cross.
Right.
That cross is referring to, and again, that's where, you know, things that have been racialized that shouldn't be. My cross is referring to my sinfulness.
That's it.
All right, my cross is referring to my my inclinations in the natural that would lead me away from God. And those are the things that I am to bear and wrestle with and kill right. on the daily. None of that has anything to do with my culture, my skin color, or any of that. So you can miss me with that one.
Go on that.
Let me get back, because I completely went off on a tangent and didn't fully answer your question. So you said, what steps can we take as millennials to kind of push against systemic racism? So one, we need to call out, I think more than anything, this generation is not going to have a problem. Black millennials will not have a problem acknowledging and mm-hmm. calling out racism as sin. And to go a step further to say that it's not an individual issue. That white evangelicals want to believe this myth that killing black males by police is every time an individual isolated event. No, it's not. Right. It's a part of a culture.
Right.
It's a part of a system.
Right.
You know, so we need to do more of that and push into that and push for reforms in those areas. And I'm a pastor. Like, we can't just, I have the difficult job of trying to speak balance into conversations that are completely off kilter and fueled by emotion. Right. And so we have to still say, like, the civil rights movement was effective because it was led by black preachers.
That's it.
That's Christians it. Were at the forefront of it.
Don't forget, Christians, we got now, receipts, y'all.
Christians now seem to be hanging back and afraid to get into the conversation because some of the voices and ideologies or philosophies are not Christian inherently. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not afraid to say that BLM is not a Christian organization.
Right.
And that we should have some questions about some of their ideology.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can also say that I can ally with somebody that
that's right.
completely share my views.
That's right.
Who is working towards a common goal.
Yeah.
And that's where I go, oh, I'm cool with saying Black Lives Matter and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And
it doesn't mean that you're I
fully ascribe to them.
Right. And it doesn't mean that you're reciting incantations out here and crap, like no. calling forth your ancestors by saying, say her name and stuff. Like, I'm not, no. like, you're not worshiping Breonna Taylor or George Floyd no. by saying their name. You're saying, hey, this is a problem. We need to fix it.
Yeah. And saying her name is a reminder of her story. And
right.
why we need to be, you know, putting some action behind our words. So, you know, as Black Christians, we gotta be a voice for prayer
yeah.
and spiritual disciplines and invoking God, you know, in the midst of this discourse.
Yeah.
While at the same time going, yeah, but I'm gonna ally myself with people that may not believe and think the same way that I do.
Yeah. And you ain't going to hell for it.
And I'm not putting nobody in hell. I don't have that power.
Right.
I can't do that.
And you yourself ain't going to hell for like associating yourself with those people.
No. No. Not no more than Jesus is going to hell for associating with a prostitute.
Right.
Or a tax collector. Or, you know, or a cussing sailor. You know.
I think that's like unclean. one of the best characterizations of Peter I've ever heard.
He was a violent cussing sailor.
Right.
So we're not guilty by association. As a matter of fact, that's a gospel command that we ally ourselves, that we infiltrate and incorporate people into our lives that don't think and believe the same thing that we do.
Yeah.
But we do that so that we can have gospel influence. We're bringing light to dark situations to reclaim that misperceived racist language.
There it is.
So the other two things, and then I'm done. We got to do the work of dismantling the systems.
Mm-hmm.
You got to call them out and acknowledge them, and talk about them not in an individual but collective ways, but also systemic ways that they have manifested themselves. And then that means we've got to do the work.
Yes.
That means as millennials, since we have a reputation, because I'm a millennial, I'm just on the older end.
Man, I always forget how old you are. I'm just like, Kobe stays young. Yeah. Like, I'm just...
I'm almost in the 40, you know, demographic. So, but the oldest millennials are 39.
Wow.
So I remind people, yeah, I'm a millennial too.
Don't get it twisted, my guy.
Don't get it twisted. Boo-boo. But we've got to dispel the myth that we have, or the label that's been placed on us as millennials, that we don't have, that we're impatient, and that we can't persevere.
Yeah.
You know, we are a microwave generation, so we want it quick. And I just go, that's a compliment to me.
Yes.
That means I don't have time to wait. You know, wait for, I guess, the longer arc of history to play out. Like, I'm going to be the gas pedal to push for,
yes,
for change and progress.
That's the MLK talk right there.
That's MLK. Yeah. The fierce urgency of now.
Of now. Yeah, there it is. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And then lastly, to use some language that I hear in leadership circles and all that sort of stuff, take measurable action to reconcile.
Measurable action to reconcile.
Yeah, we're always talking about, you know, I forget the acronym now, but SMART goals.
Yes. You
know, SMART goals.
That's it.
And one of those letters, M, is for measurable.
Yes.
And so let's take measurable action to reconciliation racially.
Mm.
And how can we do that? So that we know that we're making progress and know that we're actually working towards the goal.
Mm. Accountability.
I told you I'm in that bridge category where I'm kind of like Gen X and kind of,
yeah,
millennial. So
that's good stuff. And then like for other people who are like not like privy to these things, who are still learning. I'm talking about white people.
Okay. And anybody else that needs to get themselves educated on,
right? Because not all skin folk are you can folk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you know, if you realize that you are ignorant in some area, and ignorance is not a negative term, it just means you don't know. Then you need to surround yourself with people that are educated in that area.
Right. Not just random person, not just your coworker, not just your cousin.
Yes. Yeah.
Significant other, your cousin's significant other who just happened to be black. Come on. Not just someone who talks the way that you do, not necessarily the sound of their voice. I'm talking about the language in which they use, mm-hmm, and they,
mm-hmm,
it just reinforces your, you know, confirmation bias and everything. We're talking about,
yeah, get outside of your echo chamber.
Yes.
Intentionally get outside of, you know, the folks that you normally go to. If I hear one more person bring up Ben Shapiro and Candace Owens, and I forget, there's an older guy, not Clarence Thomas, but there's another older guy. I just saw a video with him.
I think I know what you're talking about. Then the Hodge twins.
Yeah, the Hodge twins. Silk and Diamond, I think they finally got phased out. You know, you've got to step outside of folks that are flash in the pan and just reiterate what you already think.
Right.
You've got to be challenged. Like, in every discipline, in order for us to grow, we have to be challenged in.
Yeah.
Like, Toya and I, we went to the gym this morning, you know, and I don't go to the gym because I like it. I go to the gym because I know I'm going to be challenged and I have to push and work to be better and to grow. And the same way with our brains, with our minds, how we think, we have to step outside. So find who are the experts in this area, like Ibram Kendi, Jamar Tisby.
Great writer, great book, great content creator, Jamar Tisby. Look, you know,
Michelle Alexander. Like, you got to find wife. Who. We went to see her when she was in Indy.
Yeah, at Butler.
Right at Butler, yeah, for clues. Yeah, just dropping gems.
Bruh, yeah. I was eating and I was sitting there like salivating and everything. Like, this woman, hallelujah.
Well, in the Indy area, CTS. Christian Theological Society, Society Seminary.
Yeah,
I don't necessarily align with their faith statement or some of their theology, but social justice, like, they got it.
They
like,
own it, right?
Dr. Busack was Dr. Alan Busack. You probably never even heard of this guy.
Maybe, but I don't know.
He was an activist in South Africa during apartheid.
Wow.
Like, he's up there with Mandela and Tutu and them.
Wow.
You know, and he's on the staff there. Dr. Frank Thomas. You know, these are people that, you know, they may not be household names, but they're experts in their field.
Yeah.
And we as millennials need to humble ourselves to sit at the feet of people like that, where we can glean wisdom and knowledge from on how to move the ball forward.
Right. Because it's like, otherwise we find ourselves believing this narrative. And like, I made a post about this a couple of months ago. It's like sometimes people, especially in evangelical spaces, are convinced that Black Christians are dumb and that we don't know what the heck we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
In so many
like
words.
There are no Black theologians, you know. I mean, in seminary, why am I having trouble saying this word? Seminaries. I keep wanting to go seminars.
Yeah.
In seminaries, it's rare that a Black theologian is taught. And if they are, they're taught from the negative perspective, like Black liberation theology,
right?
You know, Black liberation theology and critical race theory are completely tossed out because of the negative aspects of the theories themselves. But they don't need to be fully embraced, but they do need to be studied. And if you're talking about something analytically and critically, then you need to be able to, you know, eat the meat and spit out the bones. So
that's right.
So Dwight Hopkins and James Cone, Black liberation theologists need to be studied, because there is some truth in what those guys were saying. And we see it played out in society, and the same with CRT today.
Right.
And just throw it out. We got to consider it.
That's right. And like, my way of thinking is like, even if there's something that's like theologically disagreeable or arguable, you got to have an understanding of what led them to these ideas to begin with and focus on that, focus on the problem that led them to think in a way that you may not necessarily find quote unquote compatible with the gospel. You know what I'm saying? It's like, there's an explanation for why this person exists. And we need to critically look at that. There's an explanation that, as to why the Hebrew Israelite exists. Because like,
I so want to have a discussion with you about Black Hebrew.
Oh, let's do it. Like season three, we're going there. Yeah.
I so want to talk about that.
I'm here for it, man. I'm ready. I'm gonna definitely have you back on, man. Like, this this is just the first time we're having you on this podcast. But yeah, like, and because like theology and like, this is why I don't really want to go to seminary like that. But if I do, I don't want to go at it at the angle of like, I constantly have to critically look at white theologians, because that's y'all's base over here. You build everything off of a Calvin, everything off of Luther, everything off of whomever, X, Y, and Z.
Wesley, Spurgeon,
yes, Kierkegaard,
Edwards. Oh yeah, okay. You going the big hitters? Yeah.
I told you I went to a small Christian university, predominantly white. These were, like you said, like some of these were household names. But I had the slightest clue who was black and talking about this stuff. I got this. I got a book around here somewhere. I got a couple books that I picked up that focus primarily on black theology, from the roots, not only the roots of struggle. Because, like, yes, you know, African enslavement, there is a, you know, there's a theological framework that was built, you know, from that is totally applicable to how we navigate in this world today. But then there's even beyond that, and this is the way that we need to look at Black history. Black history is not just Black struggle to now, which is continuous Black struggle. It's like also Black excellence, and not Black excellence as in like we struggled to get here per se, or struggled in the face of whiteness, but we were here already doing this stuff and doing well. Like, so yeah. We need to be studying the Coptic Christians over in Ethiopia and seeing what, like, probably one of the most foundational, original forms of Christianity looked like. Mm-hmm. And guess what? They black. Yeah. Or at least brown. I don't know, but.
Well, Coptics were Egyptian. But the Ethiopian Christians are some of the oldest Christians that can trace their lineage all the way back to the Ethiopian eunuch that Philip evangelized to. And even further back beyond that, there are Black Israelites, Black Jews,
right,
in Ethiopia that can go back thousands of years.
Thousands.
And so, you know, it almost, if I was to read a history book or just, you know, do some research, according to who's writing the history is the narrative that we're going to get. And so if I had been born under a rock and emerged and then started consuming massive amounts of history through textbooks and whatever, I would think that Black people only existed for the last 400 years.
Wow.
And that they only existed in the context of enslavement.
Mm.
We rarely ever talk about historically the origins of, you know, beyond slavery, beyond the transatlantic slave trade. And go to what were Black people like before?
Right.
can we be all 100? Like, can we get all the way 100? What were Black people like in Africa before the arrival of white Europeans?
Come on. You're saying something.
and this is where I'm talking about. I think we'll speak to both the white evangelical mentality and the rise of Black Hebrew Israelites and other cult groups.
Yeah.
Because what both of them prop up is a mindset that Christianity is white and a tool of enslavement.
Right.
But what they don't acknowledge is the presence of Black Christians in Africa predating slavery.
Yes. Had a whole conversation with somebody about that. Go ahead.
I was preaching through the Advent story this month and talking about, you know, one of the stories I highlighted was Jesus, Mary, and Joseph's escape into Egypt.
Yep.
You know, so Jesus was being raised in Africa.
Come on now.
And we never talk about that.
Right.
You know, so what type of,
and if they're white, they would have stuck out like a sore thumb there. Like, come on now.
I don't even need to get into the skin color of Jesus. Like, I just think it's important that God saw fit that he said,
yes,
I'm going to intentionally include.
Come on.
I'm going to have the gospel writers intentionally include the fact that the Son of God and man spent a considerable amount of time during his early developmental years in Africa.
Wow.
And what type of influence that potentially could have had on his life and Christianity as a whole. You know, and not only that, how many people as a result of the Christian diaspora after Pentecost went not just north into Europe,
right,
but went south into Africa and east west into Asia.
Oh, sorry, my bad.
Yeah.
I think like some new studies are showing a couple of things in that. I haven't looked at it yet, so sorry, I misspoke.
Yeah, well, north and west into Europe, but you're talking about demographic or geographically from where Israel is. Northwest is Europe. Southwest is Africa, and east is Asia.
Okay.
And we don't talk about. We only talk about Christianity's influence and push into Europe when it was big in Africa and Asia, you know. And so anyway, I'm getting,
we taught them some stuff. Yeah, man, real quick, because it's on my mind, like I learned from people who are listening to this podcast, y'all really need to listen to the Jude 3 Project podcast. Like, they got some heat. And like from there, I learned that the term the Trinity was actually coined by an African theologian, or at least one who was like born and raised in Africa, African descent.
Was it Athanasius?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's like y'all better put some respect on our names. We've been doing this stuff.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, those councils, those early church councils, you'll discover a lot that'll surprise you.
And no, it's not when the Bible was written. No, it's like, sorry, that's my bad. Let me close that one real quick, because that'll lead us into a whole, we will get there. Yeah. We will get there one of these days.
Yeah, yeah, that's a whole nother discussion. But yeah, you know, that when you really start digging into history, I'm telling you, that's why I love it so much. When you start digging into history, you start finding out, oh wow, how much has been repressed,
yes,
you know, and silenced in favor of other voices. I love Hamilton, the Broadway musical Hamilton. The story of Hamilton, I know you sound like it. But the one of my favorite songs in Hamilton is "Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story."
Okay, because that sounds nice.
That's what history is all about.
Yeah.
Who gets to tell the story?
Yes.
And who lived and who died, you know. So I could go into a whole other thing about that, but I know we low on time. So
I appreciate that. And then like I know I'm going to turn some people away when I get into my thing about Hamilton. And I do like that. I do like what you just said there. And I'm a keep
everybody
that one.
I'm gonna like it.
It's just, I don't know. I'll just say it real quick for people who are listening. Like, what is this guy saying? I just think that we need to come to a point in time. And like, maybe we can see Hamilton as like, either like the foot in the door or like the gateway towards getting true diversity in the Broadway sphere. My thing is like, it just didn't sit well with me seeing Black and brown people portraying people who owned Black people. I'm like, that's kind of weird. Like, I see what you were trying to do. So like, I have criticisms. Yeah. Not that I don't like it, I have criticisms. I haven't watched it, but I have criticisms. Yeah. I guess that's what I'm saying. But that's neither here nor there.
No, I totally get you. I just think the overarching story of what they were trying to do, I can get down with that in spite of those things that you listed. Because, yeah, I mean, it is weird to see a black man playing Thomas Jefferson.
Right.
You know.
Unless they're trying to redeem his story. Unless we're trying to redeem his ethnic identity, because, like, you know, okay. I see you shaking your head. You're like, no, no, no. Cool. I was trying to give somebody the benefit of the doubt. I'm trying to like it. I'm trying to get
The songs, you know, that was a whole movement. Lin-Manuel Miranda sparked a movement with Hamilton in the diversity of his cast. You know, and you know, Pence, Vice President Pence,
I remember,
came to one of those shows and they went after him, you know, from the stage.
What about?
About diversity or the lack thereof in their administration. So I get it. There's tension there, but you know, I always, I'm an optimist at the end of the day.
Yeah. And look, that's what it's all about. That's why I even bring up these conversations, not to just, you know, circulate the idea of like struggle, like we're in a struggle, things are terrible, but it's like what, Esau Macaulay, I don't know if I pronounced his last name right.
Another great one. Yeah,
it's saying in like it's in the title, Reading While Black, as an exercise in hope. It's like we're having these conversations to bring about a sense of hope, because I will stand to this till Jesus come back. Like the gospel is the saving power that we need to. Like when Christ comes back, he's going to dismantle all of this. So if you don't like it now, you're going to have a rude awakening when he comes back. And it's like, that is the only hope that this world has.
Yeah.
And so it's our responsibility not only to, you know, proclaim the glory of the gospel, but the glory of the gospel is also the work that of, you know, the plow going to the dirt and, you know, rooting up the weeds as well as planting the seeds in good ground and actually fostering good ground as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love Esau Macaulay's another one of those heavy hitters and experts in this area that I didn't mention earlier. So.
Hey, you know, it happened anyway. Like, that's why, like, sometimes I even like try to silence myself as often as possible when I even bring on guests to this podcast. Cause I'm like, you know, there are going to be times where like God will bless me and the things I wanted to say that person said. And I'm like, you know what, if my goal is for this thing to be said on this podcast, if someone else says it and I don't, it's okay. The mission was accomplished.
Yeah.
And it was a part of God's design if it happened. So look, we tag team on that. Well, look, Pastor Colby Hill, thank you so much for joining us on the Unapologetics podcast. Where can people find you to follow you and also follow your church? Go ahead, put in those plugs.
Okay, I get to self-advertise.
Of course, man. We're supporting everybody here.
Well, you can find the church right now. It's encountergod.church. Mm-hmm. That's our website. In 2021, we're going through a name change. So new vision, new name. So stay tuned for that. I'm on Facebook personally at Colby Hill 317. And then coming soon, I'm going to have a curated Instagram and Twitter presence. Probably under my name, just at Colby Hill, maybe at Colby Hill 301, if that handle's available. So check me out.
Bad. And there will be, I'm just thinking about what you were saying earlier on about Instagram, like there will be no booty girls there unless they're coming to Jesus. That's all it is.
Man, I don't have a problem ministering to lost souls, but that is not the way I want to do it. Yeah, so I will have people running my social media coming up. I won't be doing it myself. I'll have influence, but it won't be me for that specific person.
Purpose. Curated.
Yes.
Emphasis on the rated. Let me stop. Oh, man. Well, yeah. Well, thank you once
again. Stay saved and married.
Saved him. Amen. Amen. Well, cool. Tell everybody I said, what's up? I miss seeing y'all. I keep forgetting to send things for your son, for our birthday, you know, your son and mine birthday. Like I was hesitant one time because I was going to give him some coupons. It was like little things such as like, maybe he gets, I was going to ask you before I made some of these, cause like, I was going to try to be funny, but I was like, my funny might be an unnecessary conversation at somebody's household. Like, okay, he might get like a free pass if he gets in trouble. Like, okay, maybe you get like 10% off your punishment or something like that. I was like, you know, yeah, let me.
Totally okay.
Okay. I'll keep it light.
That's totally okay.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing more caked or more baked gooderies from Trinity. Listen. Yeah,
she got a stand mixer, like them professional nice ones. She got one of them for Christmas. So she's going to be ramping up her production here in 2021.
Hey, yeah. Look, let me know how people can contribute when that happens. I love baked items, so I'll gladly be a patron for that in some degree.
Yeah, if there's any venture capitalists out there to help a upstart female and minority owned business, there's an opportunity there.
Look, it all comes full circle. Us talking about this language stuff. Look, we know the game, yeah, too.
Well, man, it's the third day of Kwanzaa, bro. It's, you know,
yes.
We got to talk about empowerment.
Right. Is it a Ujumi? Is that how you say it?
I think today is Ujima.
Ujima. Yeah.
I have to look it up. I knew the first two, but I don't have them all memorized.
I don't either. I had the first one memorized because I was in the I was a Botillion. Yeah, I was a bow. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like we. Yeah,
today is Ujima.
Gotcha.
Collective work and responsibility.
Gotcha. And this is only like my second year, like intentionally celebrating Kwanzaa. Now, look, listen, y'all. Y'all better put some respect on this pastor's name. This man celebrates Kwanzaa without shame, unapologetically. I saw it on this timeline. I'm like, yes. And he said specifically, this is a non-religious holiday, so don't get into it. Don't try to come for me.
Yeah, I've had some people slide in my DMs, you know, and I'm glad because they had questions and they were like, I never knew. This is what I was told, you know, and so I never knew that Kwanzaa wasn't a religious holiday and all that sort of stuff. I was like, yep, it's actually something that anybody could celebrate.
Right, come on now. Let me stop. We're about to start a whole new episode, but yeah, thank you once again. A pleasure to have you on. I'm gonna try some way to get you back. We will have that conversation about Hebrew Israelism. I don't think that's the term I'm looking for, but like, yeah, Hebrew Israelites and all that. A plethora of other topics. Them too, because. Yeah, thank you. Well, there you have it, fam. I hope that this episode was a blessing to you. I'm quite sure there's a lot more that we could have talked about, a lot more that we could have addressed. If you are interested in like doing some intentional work in this area, I invite you to my Patreon, where like I could probably at least get you started on some things aside from what you've heard already here in this episode. But those are only for the patrons who are there on Patreon. And also, I have a lot more to say about this Capitol Storm situation. Not really about the events of the situation, but the conversation surrounding that situation as it pertains to what I was mentioning, a lot of what I was mentioning in the introduction here in this episode. So, well, aside from that, there are also two live videos that I did talking about this thing, or at least starting a conversation about it, like where I get, you know, a little bit deeper into the inconsistencies I was pointing out and whatnot. So like, if you follow me on Facebook, you can find those things, or I have like one that I put on my personal Instagram. You can find me there as well. @_scribe. Yeah. And last but not least, I also have, I want to make an announcement. I have an email address now, like one that's exclusive to things this podcast and all things A Scribe. So if you want to email me like any questions or thoughts or anything, you can email me at ascribewrites@gmail.com. There is no plus sign in A Scribe because they don't let me do those fancy things, but A Scribe Writes, that is ascribewrites@gmail.com. Yeah. So we got a lot of work to do, but that work is worth it. This is the Unapologetics Podcast, where here we are unapologetically Black, unapologetically Christian, and unapologetically unconditioning racist language in the church with no apologies.